Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian reminder that the government of Venezuela sucks. I am Matt Welch, joined by a laughing Nick Gillespie and Peter Suderman and Catherine Mangu Ward. What's new, colleagues?
Hola.
Hi, Matt.
Happy Monday.
We're going to talk about the remarkable reversal of fortunes in the 2024 presidential race here in a moment. But first, a word from our friends, sponsors over at Students for Liberty.
The most important ideas are those debated on college campuses. Think about how many different fringe concepts initially spawned in the academy that are now prevalent across society. F.A. Hayek noticed this phenomenon. The ideas developed in academia soon spread to the rest of society. That's why Students for Liberty supports students like me in spreading the ideas of liberty on campuses. As a coordinator with SFL, I've hosted high-profile speakers to discuss the pressing issues of the day, published magazines and articles to spread pro-liberty ideas, and helped organize and attend conferences on campuses around the world. SFL connected me with partner organizations, and thanks to SFL, I've been accepted to internships at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, National Review, the Cato Institute, and will start as an assistant editor at Reason Magazine this summer. My name is Jack Nicastro, and I'm one of the thousands of volunteers from the SFL network building a freer future for people across the globe. Visit spreadliberty.org to discover how you can contribute to building a freer future at school and beyond.
Okay, it was literally just 9 days ago when Republicans were high-fiving in the end zone after their victorious national convention in Milwaukee. Democrats were reeling after 25 or so excruciating days of a weekend at Bernie's presidential campaign. And meanwhile, the math geeks were rubbing it in by pointing out that Donald Trump, fresh off of an assassination attempt, was stretching out a lead he'd been holding over President Joseph Robinette Biden II all damn year long. Then, whoops, not only did Vice President Kamala Harris get the coveted Biden endorsement when he dropped out of the race 9 days ago, she basically sewed up the entire nomination process in a matter of hours, raised more than $200 million dollars and did something I never thought I would see in my lifetime, which is generate a euphoric reaction to Kamala Harris. Meanwhile, it's been cat ladies all the way down for the suddenly embattled and backpedaling Republican vice presidential pick, J.D. Vance, who is getting oppo strafed with his past edgelordia, while party backbenchers are already beginning to get the knives out. Harris, by the way, is expected to announce her own beep pick here any damn day. And the polls, for the first time all year, are basically neck and neck, with Harris now getting an extra little bump anytime that you list the other third party candidates running for president. Catherine, what have we learned this past week about Kamala Harris, about the Democratic Party, about the media, about ourselves during this, the maybe short-lived, maybe long-lived K-Hive honeymoon?
Absolutely no one has learned anything at all, I feel confident in saying. We will be returning to all of our old bad patterns shortly. But in the meantime,
wait, a lot of people learned what brat is.
Some people learned what brat is. So I guess that's something. Although, are those people really sure? Because I think a lot of people have made videos under the mistaken belief that they know what brat is, and they're still getting it wrong. So I think the interesting question here is, like, did the Republican Party girl boss too close to the sun? Like, they really did too good of a job of convincing America that Joe Biden was a doddering old man who really wasn't fit to run for the presidency for a second term. Now, I think they did have the virtue of being true, right? Like, they had the truth on their side there. But actually, it seems clear in retrospect, they would have preferred to let the elites of the Democratic Party keep that under wraps for a little bit longer until it was too late to replace him. So I guess what we all learned is to be careful what we wish for. Matt. Mm.
Peter, we talked last week a little bit about some of Kamala Harris's kind of extreme flip-flopperies on policy proposals, depending on where she is in any given campaign. We talked about Medicare for all or not. She also has a little defunding the police or being the police, pot legalization, and so forth. I saw over the weekend that Harris has said, well, actually, unlike 2019, I oppose a ban on fracking, which, good, What other policy, let's say, revisitations are you looking for or seeing or even predicting?
So I think the big question with Harris is where she is going to fall on issues related to big corporations and trade, in particular antitrust and trade policy. So the Biden administration has basically taken the Trump tariffs and then extended and expanded them, adding electric vehicles and other things to the list of stuff that is essentially taxed at the border. And there are some questions about whether or not Harris would pursue quite as aggressive a strategy on trade. If so, I think Trump would probably see that as an opening to push a populist agenda even more. And then the other thing is that there's questions about whether or not she is going to want to pursue antitrust in the same way that Biden has. Biden, issued a whole of government, a sort of a directive to every agency early in his presidency to seek out a kind of maximalist antitrust strategy and approach. Basically, find places where you can pursue antitrust litigation. And then he also appointed Lina Khan to the head of the Federal Trade Commission, and Khan has been at least one of and maybe the point person for the Biden administration pursuing a slew of cases against mergers in particular. Most of those, the good news is, that most of those cases have lost in court, and that because those cases have lost in court, they have generated some backlash against Democrats who were never particularly comfortable with Khan anyway. She's quite young, and she's seen as quite radical. She's also seen as not just ambitious, but as somebody who has sort of pursued cases that she should have known would fail. And that even if you sort of want a little more aggressive antitrust, there's a bunch of people out there who think that because she has pursued these cases that are so sweeping, but also so vague and so nearly certain to be doomed in court, that she has set back the cause of sort of real antitrust reform. And so I think even within Democratic circles, you're going to see at least some open questions about whether she's going to stay at the top of the FTC and whether a Harris administration would pursue the same kind of antitrust agenda. At the same time, you opened this with Harris keeps flip-flopping on everything. And sometimes she comes out and takes a really hard stance, co-sponsoring a Medicare for All bill that would strip nearly every American of private health insurance, basically make private health insurance as we know it totally illegal. And she runs and campaigns on that and is like, yeah, let's do it. Let's get rid of private health insurance when she's first asked about it. And 6 weeks later, she's like, no, I don't support that at all. So absolutely anything that I just said, any of the things that we think we might know about what Kamala Harris's economic policies are as of this Monday morning, they might change tonight or tomorrow or next year or any time at all, because what we have seen from her time and time again is that she is not someone who has committed positions when it comes to economic policy issues. You can count on her to back big government and kind of the Democratic standby policies. She's a sort of generic Democrat in a bunch of ways. She wants to spend more on a bunch of stuff. But other than that, like the specifics of it, you have no idea what she's going to support today, tomorrow, next week, by the time the election is over.
And one reason that we don't is that she hasn't, as far as I know, given any interviews so far. So keeping the historic Joe Biden strategy of not being available to for cross-examination unless it's
why
by,
would she need to give interviews?
Comedian.
Look at the press she is getting, without giving any interviews.
We will talk about that in due course, young Suderman. Nick, did you join Mayor Pete in the White Dudes for Harris Zoom call over the weekend? And if not, why not?
I had some technical issues, Matt. So
you don't self-identify. I mean, as far as I know, you're still kind of swarming.
No, but I want to suggest that this campaign, more than most, it's not going to be whether or not Lina Khan or somebody else is running, the FTC or anything like that. It's going to be about big sweeping vibes. And then, certain details will come up that have to do with that and things like that. But what Kamala, and I think what she's trying to do, is to posture as an optimistic candidate. We're not going to hear. She's not going to revisit Medicare for All. She'll say she's going to make healthcare more affordable for everybody.
Yeah, that's right.
It is. And she has to deal with things like immigration. How do you deal with the fact that she was the border czar, and the, you know, the press bent over backwards to say, you know, not only she was never in charge of anything related to immigration, she's never even been to the border or out of the country or with 250 miles of any border of America, things like that. She's got to come up with a plausible way to talk about what she's going to do about the border, but then also appeal to immigrants and to people who don't hate immigrants. Trump, coming out of the assassination attempt, and for the first, you know, third to maybe half of his Republican acceptance speech at the RNC, was positive. He was, you know, we are going to go forward. Everybody is welcome. By the end of it, he was in full Frank Costanza mode, going through all of the, you know, listing all of the problems he had with people. And then you have somebody like J.D. Vance who shows up, who is just kind of, you know, like the worst case scenario. To the extent that anybody acknowledges him, they all find him a horrible, terrible, negative vision of America, right? I mean, he is speaking to the already super converted. So Kamala's, you know, the question is, what is she going to say about immigration? What is she going to say about crime? Because she can play it both ways. But if she plays the cop, which she can do, you know, with her record, she's going to piss off the left. Same thing with foreign policy. She seems to be more favorable towards Ukraine than Israel. That's kind of a problem. She had to come out and, you know, condemn people who spray painted Hamas is coming, and that all Zionists are bastards in Washington, D.C. How is she going to come up with a foreign policy where, in a way that she speaks to, you know, positive attributes of American society? And I think a big part of her challenge, and I don't think that she's up to it, and I think, you know, just to be clear, she would be a terrible president. I think she would open up many of the worst elements that were already there in the Joe Biden administration. But she has to convince people that the economy has not been as bad as everybody right and left has been talking about. And again, there's reality behind that. The economy is not as awful as everybody says. But to do that in a way where you don't alienate large sections of the people that you absolutely have to nail down is going to be a real challenge. And she has not demonstrated an ability to, you know, talk for more than a minute without giggling in a way that is deeply unsettling and helps explain why, as of the most recent poll, she has a 38.5% approval rating, according to 538, which is not only not good, it's actually below Donald Trump, who seems to be creeping up.
So I agree with Nick there, just real quick, that like if this will be an election about big sweeping vibes and not in the giant broom from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids sense, but like about just sort of the general character of sort of what you of the two candidates and sort of what they bring to table. But if Kamala Harris is elected president, she is going to have specific policies, and those specific policies are going to make big impacts on industry, on labor, on sort of different parts of the economy, on people's lives. And it's worth talking about them and taking them apart, even if we think that that's not what the election is going to be fought over. Because I think in a lot of ways, the best way you can think about this is that she's going to be a continuation of the Biden administration, but bigger, right? In the way that Joe Biden was not a progressive, not a socialist, but he was a big government liberal. Kamala Harris is a bigger government liberal.
Catherine, picking up on points that both Peter and Nick made, a headline from our own beloved Robbie Suave last week is media coverage of border czar Kamala Harris is cringe. You could probably just take out the border czar and leave at media coverage is cringe. And an example of that came today in New York Magazine, and I wish I could have surprised you with this on the podcast, as I do with tweets, but it's a visual of Kamala Harris sitting triumphantly on a coconut. And while a bunch of Democrats are like tiny in front of it and they're like partying, and it's called Kamalot. In a matter of days, Democrats discovered their future was in the White House all along.
On second thoughts, let's not go to Kamalot. It is a silly place.
What's your reaction, Catherine?
I hate it so much. I hate it so much. It's everything. It's the cringe. It's the tribalism, and it's the amnesia. It's the hypocrisy. It's all together, right? These are people who have been critical of Harris, rightly, who did not see her as an anointed successor, who, you know, stuck with Biden in large part because they didn't think there were good, viable alternatives, who are now all just like, ah, I see. New plan. She's literally Jesus. Okay. And here we go. And it's you know, it's embarrassing for everyone, I would say. The piece of it that is getting to me is the desire to make her into some kind of, you know, that she's sort of, they're trying to have her be all things to all people, which is absolutely not going to be possible. There is still just the fundamentals of this election are the same, which is it's the border and it's inflation. And she's not well positioned on either of those things. She was the fake bad, maybe not really, maybe really border czar, according to Axios. And the inflation thing is associated with Biden and voters don't like it. And Trump's not going to do any better, to be clear, on either of those things. He, in fact, likely will do worse, even on the border in particular. But once everybody takes a deep breath and calms down, those two things are still there and they're not going to go away.
From a libertarian perspective, this is bad and worse in terms of immigration policy broadly, including on the border. Just, you know, one thing that we should definitely underscore is that all of this discussion about whether or not she was the border czar, you know, and if Joe Biden gave her vanity license plate that said border czar, the most important thing is that he put her in charge of policies designed to, you know, stabilize the economies and the flow of people out of the main center countries in Latin America and in Central America. And he actually said, when she speaks for me on questions about border security and about policy of those countries. So the fact that the media has gone so far in the other direction to deny any possibility that she was ever in charge of this, when all of the same publications now that are talking about this, like, have copious articles talking about how she's in charge of the border and boy, things are going to be different now from a few years ago. That is something that is going to, I think, to the extent that people give a shit, it's going to alienate them from the media coverage, which is slobbering and detestable in its Kamala a lot type of thing. Matt, that New York Magazine cover is just kind of despicable. In every aspect of it. And when it pairs up with things like the white woman for Kamala Zoom call that Elizabeth Nolan Brown covered, and it's currently going around where literally an influencer kindergarten teacher starts lecturing at people at how to shut the fuck up when people of color are talking and how we, you know, white women have to help get Kamala, you know, elected. These are the types of things that activate and alienate not fringe people on the right, you know, not the Tucker Carlsons of the world, but rather people in the middle who are like, you know what, I kind of like this country and I want it to continue going forward. And when you see this kind of extreme overreaction by partisans masquerading as something approaching neutral journalists, that is going to have a negative impact overall, I think, on Kamala and the Democratic Party's process.
Peter, picking up on that, when these white women calls started coming forth, I found my body kind of shuddering in that awful thing that happens once in a while when you remember the year 2020. Like that, like peak insanity when it came to identity politics, just literally insanity. You can't go back and read any story about anything from July 2020 without feeling like you just dropped into the worst possible alternative universe. Are we just hypersensitive to it and being allergic to it, kind of being on the outside looking in? Or do you think that might suggest a bit of a ceiling on how high the Democratic coalition can go because they're going to alienate the normies with this crap?
So when you heard about a bunch of white women organizing to try to elevate a black woman to a new level of political power, you felt physically uncomfortable. That's what you're telling me? Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. All right. You're canceled. I am reporting that to my witches group immediately.
Like Catherine calls that the book
club. They prefer Wiccan, first of all.
I would totally vote for a Wiccan or even somebody who worships shrubs. Druids. They've got my vote.
I'm going to root for whoever staged the Marie Antoinette speed medal section of the Paris Olympics opening ceremony, which is fantastic. Go on.
I think the more serious way to answer your question is that so many people who are involved with the Democratic Party and quite committed to it are totally committed, have no other playbook other than the race and gender playbook. That's the only way they can see the world and the only way they can see politics. Because this was not white women for Kamala Harris because she's going to X, and then here's a list of policies in a way that she's going to change government. It was not white women for Kamala Harris because she's going to be good at governance. It wasn't even white women for Kamala Harris because Donald Trump is going to do this, 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 and this, and this, and this, and appoint this guy to be HUD secretary and like have this policy at the department. No, it was just white women for Harris because we're women. She's a woman. She's a woman of color. We're white. And this was explicit on the call. Like, oh, and because we're white, we have privilege and need to use, right? Like, it's just entirely a shallow race and gender approach to absolutely everything that has no real concern for meaningful governance or substance or anything else, or the thought that, say, some women, for example, might want to vote for Republicans because of, I don't know, tax policy or anything like that. It's incredibly reductive. It's stupid. It's shallow. And the fact that there are prominent Democrats or Democratic partisans still playing this just shows you that they have not been able to move beyond that. And frankly, the Kamala Harris, the way that Kamala Harris was coronated shows you that too.
Caring about tax policy is the patriarchy, Peter. And I just want you to know that you are keeping me and Kamala Harris down by doing
this. I expect a hex to come down on the rest of my day just for saying that.
It's a day ending in Y, so why not? Catherine, let's go quickly to the Veep stakes. Kamala is expected to pick a running mate any day now. The three main reported finalists are Arizona Senator Mark Kelly, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. Some scattered showers and mention out there for North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, Transpo Secretary Pete Buttigieg, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker. I'm tired of reading names. Basically, they're all over the TV this weekend, peacocking for Kamala and coming up with ever elaborate insults for J.D. Vance. Are any of these candidates of particular interest or concern for you from a libertarian point of view?
No. I mean, Becca Congdon, who is a newish reasoner that you should get to know, wrote a little post for us last week. America deserves a boring vice president. Two cheers for dull, purplish Democratic governors. And that's kind of where I'm at. At least one of the folks, and I can't remember which one, which is why it works. I think Andy Beshear is described as being like eating vanilla ice cream with no topping. And another guy, maybe Roy Cooper, is what it would look like if a sweater designed a human. And this is what I want. This is what I want. I mean, I know I will rue the day, right? In fact, I do not like standard mainstream Democratic governors. They do things that I tend to disagree with as a general matter when put in charge of their various states. But I guess the other choices are like J.D. Vance. So, okay, give me a boring governor.
Nick, any thoughts on the field?
Mostly that it's worth remembering that vice presidential candidates really don't matter very much. We can talk about the Thomas Eagleton exception, and I hope we do, because I love stories that, you know, where the intersection of politics and electroshock treatment come into play. That's always a good thing. But in general, they don't matter very much. But she seems to be almost certainly going to pick as Catherine put it, a human being designed by a sweater, somebody who is a centrist, dull, middle-aged white guy. And that means, unfortunately, she's going to look over people like Jared Polis, who's been a very successful reelected governor of Colorado, who's objectively pro-business in a very forward-looking way, but he's gay. So I predict that she will steer clear of anything that will add to the idea that this ticket is somehow like George McGovern and, for a brief shining moment, Tom Eagleton.
The Jared Polis quote that he gave when he was asked about this is so good. I'm going to slightly butcher it. I can't read it directly.
I'll read it for you.
Yeah, okay, Catherine, do you have this?
if they do the polling and it turns out they need a 49-year-old balding gay Jew from Boulder, they've got my number.
Perfect. So I haven't done the polling. I've only polled myself, I should say, and I think that's what they need.
Yeah. My one cent throwing in there is that I'm somewhat interested in Josh Shapiro, the Pennsylvania governor, as a possibility of a pick, both for the electoral considerations, but mostly just because of him for two reasons. One is that he did a very good job impersonating a decent person, at the very least, if not being a decent person, after the Trump assassination attempt, which killed someone in Pennsylvania, let's not forget. His speech about that was just great. That's what I would like to see American executives in office act like, at a time when we just don't have much decency and haven't had it in our elected officials for a good long while. And the other thing is that he's a little bit it's more like he's exciting opposition from more kind of Hamasite grassroots left. So anyone that they don't like makes me kind of somewhat interested. And he was in favor, rhetorically, of school choice until the moment he became governor. And he's like,
And the teachers, flipping on that was unfortunate, but it was he does seem to be somebody who is actually a centrist politician, at least when he's not up against elections. One thing I'll just add also on the larger point about vice presidents, they have a terrible record of delivering their home state. So, Shapiro makes a lot of sense given that Pennsylvania is a big must-win state, but
it's like Domino's and pizza, just doesn't deliver.
If not Bill Clinton minutes. Had won Al Gore's Tennessee, not Bill. No, if Al Gore had won Al Gore's Tennessee, that's right. That's the one. I remember that one.
Who are these guys again?
All right, let's go as quickly as we can, extending the Veep talk to Trump's pick, J.D. Vance. He's had a pretty rough week trying to... trying to talk his way out of previous...
Yeah, I think the couch had a tougher, man.
God,
it's been a tougher week for couches.
We're not going to do that, man.
We're not going to do that. I Why? Refuse to do couch discourse on this podcast. Okay. It's not being done.
Sure.
That's because you're a lazy boy?
I
want to
destroy everybody except for Catherine on this podcast. He called Democrats the party of childless cat ladies, and then he kind of tried to defend it and said, I like cats.
He apologized to cats.
Yeah, he suggested that parents be given more voting power than non-parents. In a plot twist, according to private emails that were unearthed with a friend or a former friend, he said that he hates the police, or he said that at least once. Democrats, with perhaps unusual temporary effectiveness, have been taking to mocking Vance as weird. Surprisingly effective. It is weird. Catherine, you are a child full non-cat owner. Mm-hmm. So how is your book club taking the Vance rollout?
Not well, I would say. We had some Negronis this last week and talked about it a little bit, and not too good with that. I mean, I find Vance to be this very recognizable type, which makes me uncomfortable, right? Like, he is a dude that I know. He is a Yale dude that I know. He is a DC dude that I know. You know, the beard, the whole vibe.
Hey.
He lives in the, I know, I said what I said. He lives in the neighborhood where I grew up in Alexandria. So he feels very recognizable to me, which isn't a comfort, right? Because I also know that those dudes are kind of not okay. Like, dudes that have been through this extremely online, semi-public, political, ideological self-discovery over the period that Vance has been trying to find himself, they're still into some wacky stuff. They're still trying out kind of different radical ideologies. And you really, first of all, shouldn't be doing that in your 40s. You should either...
Well, he's 39. He turns 40 next month.
He has six more seconds to be figuring this out. You either pick a radical ideology and you stick with it forever, like me, or you just become a normie. Those are the two choices. Picking up a fresh, weird radical ideology late in the game, those are the people I worry about. And that is also the concern of my book club. Thank you for asking.
Peter, talk about that two online element of it, if you will. It is a thing that you have noticed a lot about the Democratic Party over the years, and I think also about Ron DeSantis and his campaign and some of the things that went wrong with it. Do you see that as also kind of influencing the not necessarily great trajectory so far of Mr. Vance?
So one thing that people need to understand about J.D. Vance is that he is a poster. Like, he is a creature of the weird share everything online elder millennial lifestyle in a way that we have never experienced from a president before. The closest we or somebody in the, you know, in the proximity to the presidency. And he is the closest thing I think we might have gotten recently was something like Obama, who was a writer and who actually appeared to like write his own speeches and his, you know, at least do some drafting of his own speeches in some cases, and, you know, wrote a book, you know, that wasn't just a campaign book. But no, this is a whole additional level, to the point where he was blogging back in 2005 about how he felt more female than he'd ever felt, and because he was too emotional to watch the Zach Braff movie Garden State.
Same queen.
Which, right. Actually, right. And this is the thing, is he has this super long trail of just like leaving his feelings out there like every day for everyone to find, because he's been online this entire time. And honestly, I am not a big fan of J.D. Vance, the politician and the national figure and the weirdo. But this is the most relatable thing about him, is that he's just been writing stuff about how he's feeling about Garden State and whether the Shins will change your life for 20 years on the internet. Oh, seems pretty God. Normal to me.
I guess I was hoping horrifying. That when we got to this stage and that this kind of thing was normalized, you know, along with, I suppose, like just the general prevalence of, you know, being able to find like online dating profiles for all of our would-be candidates and that kind of thing. I guess I was hoping that it would be someone who we would be like charmed to witness their journey to adulthood and self-awareness, instead of this like chaotic kind of trolly mess.
Not a guy who described his blog as like a diary, only far more masculine.
This is when you say it's relatable. Like, this is you and I are this, Peter. And like, if we hate J.D. Vance, it's because we hate ourselves a little, but also because we hate fascism. Both.
You know, if J.D. Vance encapsulates the current crisis of masculinity that seems to be, you know, on the far right, he is a, you know, he's Matt Walsh in politics. Including the beard, sorry, Peter. But he is deeply troubled by the demise of traditional masculine roles, which are already dead by the time he was born. And that is what he's struggling with. And when you look at his politics through that light, that is what he is all about, the way where he has landed now. And all of his backers in Silicon Valley and things like that also talk about the same thing. You know, there's been too much feminization of American culture. Where are all the factory jobs and things like that? And they're hearkening back to an America that never really existed and certainly did not exist even in the 70s, which was the last gasp of deindustrialization in the Rust Belt. And in that sense, J.D. Vance can be very interesting sociologically. And I assume after he gets kicked out of politics, finally, he may end up as a guru about like the new men's movement. He'll become a Warren Farrell for the 21st century or something like that.
His destiny is morning show.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, like, maybe he'll evolve. But right now, the problem with him, as far as I'm concerned, I don't give a shit what he does to Trump's electability or anything like that. The policies that he's pushing are not only, you know, massively anti-libertarian, they're bad for the part of the country that he claims to personify and care about. You know, what he wants is a kind of national economic planning that is going to, you know, make it harder for places in Southwest Ohio to actually get businesses to live there, start businesses, get people to move there and things like that. And so it's kind of enjoyable to see his totally botched rollout, because it may signal that he, you know, this iteration, J.D. Vance, we'll call it 3.0, because he had the fuck up phase. You know, then he got it together in the Army and when he went to Ohio State and then Yale. That's and thought Trump was Hitler, you know, circa 2016. He's now in 3.0. Maybe J.D. Vance 4.0 will be an interest, you know, will be a positive figure in America. But it's just that like, remains
the
thing to be is, seen.
We're not going to child tax credit our way out of the crisis of masculinity, which I think is his current plan.
The thing about all of those versions, though, is that there's something consistent. There's a through line there, is that he has always been an e-girl. Right. He is an e-girl, except he's a boy. And right now he's a MAGA e-girl. Right. But this is the whole thing about e-girls is there's always self-reinvention. There's always some new thing that you're getting hooked on. Oh, it's Brat Summer, whatever the hell it is. Right. But it's just the through line there is a sort of ideological extremeness that is also shallow and like and isn't stuck to anything real. Right. And a huge amount. Yeah, and a huge amount of online oversharing. And that is J.D. Vance.
Yeah, that's not an e-girl. I'm sorry, Peter. That's a generational thing because he's like, you know, Tim Pool or Dave Rubin or people who are constantly remaking themselves. It's not about boy or girl. It's like, you know, that's what it is to be his age.
I have been enjoying, like Nick, much of the botched rollout. I do not enjoy a hyper-media focus on stories about a guy who aren't true, kind of snickering and saying, oh, he's got to deny this thing that isn't true. That's silly. But the stuff on the record, I hope and certainly predict and certainly hope that he's actually said is much more disturbing. And I would point people to a Vanity Fair article in 2022 by James Pogue, who's a pretty good journalist, where he was talking about J.D. Vance, the failed Blake Masters, who's still trying to win a seat in Arizona as a Republican, but it's very difficult, both of whom were kind of acolytes of Peter Thiel, who I don't think has been a positive influence in American politics, to put it mildly. Pogue's story collects a bunch of quotes where he says stuff like, I think we should seize the institutions of the left and turn them against the left. We need like a de-bathification program, de-wokification program. He uses words like regime and cathedral, this kind of, you know, Curtis Yarvin neo-reactionary lingo from the Claremont Institute of whatever they are these days.
Of masculine studies.
Most disturbingly, and it's also relevant to the fact that he's running as Donald Trump's running mate, he said, I think what Trump should do, if I was giving him one piece of advice, fire every single mid-level bureaucrat, every civil servant in the administrative state, replace them with our people, and when the courts stop you, stand before the country and say the Chief Justice has made his ruling, now let him enforce it. That is a vision of America that is awful. That is extra constitutional, that it's kind of rubbing your hand in childlike glee to imagine the next phase of the American experiment. And he deserves to lose because of that attitude and behavior in public life literally just 2 years ago. All right, we're going to move on to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, friends, do you know what's really fun? Enjoying an adult beverage or two, or more than two, with your friends and loved ones whilst engaging in stimulating conversation or listening to old jam records or watching the U.S. men's basketball team crush Johnny Serb like a grape. Best yet is when you spring up the next morning bright and early, fresher than a newborn daisy. This later bolt of happiness can be yours with a game-changing new product called ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol. Pre-alcohol is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It is this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make ZBiotics your first drink of the night. Drink responsibly and you'll feel your best tomorrow. Just go to zbiotics.com/roundtable right now to get 15% off your first order when you use the promo code roundtable at checkout. There is a 100% money back guarantee if you are unsatisfied in any way, no questions asked. That's zbiotics.com/roundtable, promo code roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder, send your brief queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Alexander Schnitker. who writes, "Dear Reason team, I hope this message finds you well. You may have heard about Project 2025, where various conservative groups collaborated to create a roadmap in anticipation of a potential Donald Trump victory in the 2024 election. Fact check, it was done before we knew that Trump would be the nominee. It was also for Ron DeSantis, etc. Anyways, what are your thoughts on libertarian organizations such as Reason, Cato, Fee, and others coming together to develop a similar roadmap? This document would outline what a complete libertarian government takeover could look like, addressing issues one by one. It would provide a clear vision of how such a transformation could improve our current system." Catherine, is this what you've been doing in all of your secret meetings with CEI and IHS?
Yes, always. I am doing the blueprint for the roadmap for the future. That's what I love.
Have you marketed a scary name? You got to get a scary name in it.
I just said it. The blueprint for the roadmap for the future, Matt. That's what it's called.
Not scary.
So I think there are two reasons why Project 2025 has like gotten everybody's hackles up. One is it's a convenient way to kind of channel concerns, totally legitimate concerns about Trump, and also about the kind of ideological institutions that are shoring him up and will staff his administration. We have an excellent feature by Stephanie Slade coming up in the next issue that will shed some light on what's going on there. But also that the idea of just making a document of stuff that a group of ideologues in Washington, D.C. would like to see happen, that's really, really common. So that's the other piece of this is like, yes, sometimes one of these kind of sticks and everybody panics about it, but people are out here making their blueprints every day, all the time. People got blueprints. There are specific ones that Peter Sunderman actually reads, and maybe he'll tell us about some of them. But the existence of the document and the existence of the coalition meetings is not the thing that is interesting or unusual. Every ideological group does those. And it's really just a question of whether they are realized in any way in the real world. The reason that people don't give as much attention to libertarian versions of these is because we are not, in fact, going to have a full takeover of government. There is theoretically a world in which Republicans might control all the branches of government in some meaningful sense. There simply isn't one in which libertarians will, at least not in the short term. And so our plans look much more incremental. They look much more collaborative and therefore look much less sinister, I hope.
I think the plan is afuera. That's afuera. It. Nick, you've been working at Reason since, I think, before the World Wide Web, right around then.
That is correct. Yeah, when they opened the LA office, they found me in a vertical filing cabinet, man.
Didn't we do this? I feel like there might have been a project like this at some point, or am I just imaginary?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I am amazed at the press backlash against Project 2025, and it is part of the extremely online left of center conspiracist mindset. And it works well, at least on Twitter, where you hear a lot of people, and I've been talking to people in New York City, and they're like, "Aren't you a little bit worried about Project 2025? Because on page 840 in a footnote, you know, they talk about X, Y, and Z." And it's like, yeah, I'm not actually worried about it. Having said that, that broad project that the letter writer is speaking of has, you know, a pedigree and a history of more or less effectiveness, where in the past groups like Heritage Foundation back in its early days in the late 70s after it was started, you know, had some of that for a Republican Party that did not yet exist, looking forward towards a Ronald Reagan ascendancy. And they pushed particularly certain types of tax and regulatory policies that ended up informing how Reagan governed, you know, once he was elected and the Republicans took over parts of Congress. The Manhattan Institute in New York did this with Rudy Giuliani. The Federal Society did a version of this for the federal judiciary, which has been massively and powerfully successful. The Democratic leader, whatever it was called, center or commission, whatever, the DLC that Bill Clinton was part of, and the Atari Democrats put out forms of what a new type of governance might look like. So the broad outlines of this project can be more or less effective, and they are worth kind of always working through those types of things, because what happens is that you never know when you're going to reach a point where something that seems politically impossible becomes politically expedient to do. I mean, and that includes somebody like Milton Friedman used to talk about this all of the time, that that's why you're constantly throwing ideas out there. What is more interesting is when you look at groups like the Federalist Society, where you build not just, you know, okay, here's a bunch of white papers or ideas, but you actually build the infrastructure to change the way that when people are in law school, how they think about stuff, where do they get clerkships? How do they get placed in positions of power? And, you know, there's that old, is it the Powell memo, named after the future Supreme Court justice, who in like around 1970 said, you know what, the free enterprise people had been totally wiped out of all powers of influence. And you know, we had lost the media, we had lost the academy, we had lost other things. We need to start building in new forms of power. And he laid out the creation of different types of think tanks and institutions and alternative media in order to start spreading what was considered then, and it seems like weak tea now, but it's basically free enterprise. And it's successful. So I like these ideas. And, you know, sometimes they work very well. Sometimes they don't.
Peter, you've been in think tanky world in addition to reason world. What say you?
So what Catherine said is totally correct. It's not just normal for all of these institutions to create comprehensive guidebooks to policy. It's also quite useful. It's useful for people like me, generalist policy journalists, who sometimes encounter bureaucratic terms or jargon that they are not familiar with, right? Like, there was a point in my life when I did not know what a Medicaid recovery audit contractor was. But fortunately, some senior fellow at some think tank has looked into that and has written about this for me. And so I can go and look that up, and that gives me a starting point to kind of understanding a bunch of these policy issues. But it's not just generalist journalists who can use this sort of thing. It's also policymakers. It's also people in government, because believe it or not, sometimes people end up in, say, appointee slots in government, and they don't know all of the finer details about how the bureaucracy that they are now in charge of running or running part of or helping to administrate, they don't know all of the stuff about how it works. Fortunately, there's a senior fellow somewhere who has put together a piece of paper, a document, or perhaps even a whole book full of them, like, for example, Cato's Handbook for Policymakers, which is excellent and just a useful guide to more or less all of the stuff that government should be doing or shouldn't be doing, and exactly how it should or shouldn't be doing those things. There are magazines like National Affairs, which are not quite comprehensive outlines, but sort of attempt to put out there, like, here's how to think about this policy issue, and here's a plan for addressing it. And you can just go and read all of the articles about how to deal with Medicaid recovery audit contractors, or how to achieve school choice, or whatever it is you're looking for. And the idea is you have these ideas, they're on the shelf already. And that way that when some sympathetic figure or just sort of somebody in government wants to know, what should I do here? They don't have to figure it out from scratch. They don't have to start from the beginning. Somebody has already looked into this and at least given them a starting point. So these things, I think, are normal, and they are valuable, and they are useful to basically everyone who works in government, thinks about government, or just wants to know kind of what government should or shouldn't be doing from the perspective of whatever institution.
All right. President Biden today is scheduled to reveal a package of suggested alterations to the Supreme Court, including term limits of 18 years, a constitutional amendment to overturn the court's recent presidential immunity ruling, and a binding enforceable ethics code, which would make justices, quote, required to disclose gifts, refrain from public political activity, and recuse themselves from cases in which they or their spouses have financial or other conflicts of interest, end quote. In a Washington Post op-ed, the lame duck president wrote, what is happening now is not normal, and it undermines the public's confidence in the court's decisions, including those impacting personal freedoms. We now stand in a breach. Anyway, Catherine, let's do a lightning round, start a lightning round with a quick reaction. Do we like these ideas? Do we not? What do we think?
If you are worried about undermining trust in the court or the eroding of trust in the court, let's say proposing a bunch of reforms that you absolutely have no reasonable chance of implementing is not a good way of solving that problem. Biden is out of time. He does not have the resources to do this. In some cases, he doesn't have the authority to even really be doing proposals for this. And so all he is going to do is further reinforce the message that the court is no longer functioning, cannot be trusted, and should be at the beck and call of the other branches of government. This is not going to help.
Nick, term limits, age limits?
Biden is a very good demonstration of the need for term limits and age limits, but he is beyond a lame duck. He's Tommy in the Who opera pre-breakthrough. He is deaf, dumb, and blind. Nobody will listen to him, which is a good thing because these ideas on their merits are incredibly stupid and terrible.
Peter, it seems like Biden is getting his policy ideas from ProPublica, or am I being mean?
Well, this is the second time you've brought this up in a question to me on this podcast. Several weeks ago, I think it was, you pointed to the ProPublica investigations into Supreme Court justices who had been appointed by Republicans and asked me, is this building to something? And I said, well, to something, but they didn't know what it was. It wasn't a coherent, sort of fully thought out plan with a roadmap from A to Z. It wasn't Project 2025, right? Like with the whole thing thought out in advance. It was just like, we're gonna keep pressing here until something happens. This is the something. And it's not great. Joe Biden's going to be out in the Washington Post saying, telling the American people what's happening now is not normal. No, it's kind of normal in the sense that what is happening is that Democrats are attempting to politicize the one part of government that they have the least influence over right now. And it's just kind of gross and ugly, especially because, as Catherine said, these aren't even it wouldn't make them better if they were real reforms that were likely to pass. But there is a sense in which they know this is not going to happen. They have to be aware that this is at least constitutionally dubious. And it's just about trying to degrade the sense that the Supreme Court has any legitimacy. That's not great for government.
Do we think it's a fair test that anytime someone who holds actual political power proposes a constitutional amendment, that is the same thing as them saying, I don't know, I'm just going to demagogue this?
Yes.
Okay, but what if the amendment is to repeal prohibition?
So let's get to our end of podcast, cultural recommendations. Catherine, why don't you start us off?
I went and sat in a Cybertruck.
Wow.
That's what I did. That's my cultural.
I saw my first Cybertruck today. They're so big.
They're very,
Not
very
today,
large.
Like this weekend, though.
They're very large. It was pretty cool, honestly. Like, longtime listeners to this podcast will know, I struggle with my desire for Elon Musk to be super cool and the reality of Elon Musk, which is that he is less than super cool in many areas. But I have to say, I thought the Cybertruck was pretty neat. It basically seemed like a giant refrigerator, like the stainless steel on your refrigerator that you like bang into it one time with like a metal can and it gets a little dent in it and that little dent bothers you forever. I think that would probably happen on the Cybertruck.
That doesn't sound scientific.
But also it was I have refrigerator discourse thoughts, but they're about the Cybertruck.
People does it sit? See,
it's large inside, I would say. Like the formal seating, I don't know, because I wasn't really thinking about it as a family car, but the interior is very large and very spacious. And of course, you could put as many people as you want in the bed of the truck, as long as you are in a state that permits that. So the Tesla Cybertruck is kind of cool, is my cultural consumption for this week.
So you're thinking of it as a getaway car from your family is what I'm
it's
hearing.
It's a sports car. It's a recreational vehicle, uh-huh. not a
midlife crisis. I get it.
Can you describe the circumstances under which you were in a Cybertruck?
I walked by a Tesla showroom and thought, I'm going to go in there and sit in the Cybertruck.
That a girl. Nick, what did you consume?
So I have been trying to figure out exactly when the current epoch began. And as part of my search for that, I rewatched the 1976 movie, The Bad News Bears, which I would argue, and I think, Matt, we are in general agreement about this, that along with The Godfather, it's probably the movie that helps explain America as much as any other pop culture icon or item of the certainly past 50 years.
Certainly is a documentary of some of our childhoods.
So what, you know, it came out in 1976. It is foul-mouthed, and it helped mainstream two things that are very important. One is out-of-control children who seem sweet and cute and then are incredibly foul-mouthed and non-responsive to authority, even as they ask for it. When you look at the kids there, it is, you know, who are effectively Gen X kids, I guess, mostly, or late boomers, are really very much like millennials and Gen Z. And it was described as charming and playful. I watched it on Amazon streaming, which is not at all what it should be. I watched it with my fiance, who's a millennial, who was freaked out by almost everything about it, including the Little League baseball coach played by Walter Matthau is an alcoholic who goes into vaguely fugue states when he is not drinking as much Schlitz, Budweiser, or Coors, which are among the three beers that he drinks copiously throughout the movie, and he gets angry and mean and nasty. But this is a movie that captures exactly the moment when adults in authority lost the ability to control the script and kids were not ready for it yet. And I think if you go back and look at that movie, it tells us a lot about the looseness of the structures and where institutions have failed, but whatever is going to replace them has not yet come up. And it's a delightful movie. It's a great movie with Walter Matthau, Tatum O'Neill, and the tragic Vic Morrow, who is one of the great kind of semi-villains in this, where he's a father who shows up but is kind of a dick to Brandon Cruz, who had been in The Courtship of Eddie's Father as a dutiful son and then became a lead singer in a fairly well-known Bay Area punk band. So there's so much. It's just a fabulously rich text. It's also late July. And, you know, so I think a lot about Little League. Matt, I think I showed this to you before, but I'll do it again. This is my 1975 championship winning Little League team from Middletown, New Jersey. We were called the MPs because we were named after Middletown Pizza. And I'll leave it there.
It's no Chico's Bail Bonds, but it comes close.
Let freedom ring. Let freedom ring.
I can't imagine what it's going to take to wake Catherine up after that. No,
but it coarsened and vulgarized America, or it recognized this the society we had become. At one point, Jackie Earle Haley, who in a year and a half was going to be a monstrous post-pubescent kind of troglodyte in movies for the next 40 years, but he's wearing a homegrown weed T-shirt. Another kid is wearing a shirt who's 11 years old and is wearing a shirt with smoking a Budweiser can on it. And they're all smoking.
It's fantastic. Yeah. It is a perfect
It's when
movie.
America became America.
I would point people to the piece that I wrote about the remake starring Billy Bob Thornton. And one of the awful things about it is that at the end, they drink near beer instead of actual beer when they're on
their victorious even drink it.
Defeat. And he also said that in order to not get an R rating, he couldn't have the kids smoking. And it's like, what are we even doing here, America? Peter, what did you consume?
So I saw Deadpool and Wolverine, and it's about Deadpool and Wolverine. And in a lot of ways, it's just a send-off to the 20th century era of 20th century Fox era of superhero movies, right? So like X-Men and Fantastic Four and Elektra, all of which were produced by a different studio than owns the Marvel Cinematic Universe, because Marvel started out as its own thing and was bought by Disney. And then Disney eventually bought Fox and has now all of the rights to all of those characters and is going to be putting them into these films. And so this is a look back and a kind of like goodbye to 20-something years of superhero movies, and in particular to Hugh Jackman's Wolverine, who was the anchor for a lot of the those films. It is extremely devoted to fan service, just at the most intense level, because it requires an understanding not only of the comic book movies themselves. It's not just that you'd had to have seen these movies, but you also have to understand all of the rights issues and the production rumors surrounding them in order to get even half of the jokes here. But even more than that, there's something else that sort of is kind of weird about this movie, which is that it's not really a movie about Wolverine and Deadpool, like I said at the beginning. It's actually a movie about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the franchise itself. So the whole plot is just that Deadpool is there to save the Marvel Universe from franchise disaster, because the Marvel Universe, as I have talked about sometimes on this podcast, it's been going on for too long. It's lost its way, right? It's kind of creaky and purposeless. So Deadpool shows up and he is, and this is the term that the movie uses. I didn't invent this. He is Marvel Jesus. He says this over and over again. He's there to be the savior for the franchise. And so this whole film is built on the premise that the franchise has like a lot riding on this movie, that it's a big deal, right? That it's got to succeed in order for the whole thing to work, right? And it's still, I know that a lot of people like this movie, but I just found it kind of fundamentally empty and vapid. It doesn't really connect. It doesn't offer anything other than shallow fan service. It's just outreach to the faithful, which means, you know what it is, folks? This is Marvel's Kamala Harris, right? It is exactly Kamala Harris and her role in the Democratic Party. Catherine already, like, I did not tee this up with her. She didn't know this was coming. She already said she's kind of Jesus for the Democrats right now. Well, she's in the way that that Kamala Harris is Democratic Jesus, Deadpool and Wolverine is supposed to be Marvel Jesus. I don't think any of them really work. On the other hand, Deadpool and Wolverine made buckets and buckets and buckets of money over the weekend. It looks like just about everybody in the country went to see it. It's a huge movie. And so maybe Kamala Harris will work too.
She also made buckets and buckets of money over the weekend.
Yeah, that's right.
They actually,
made more.
No, I think they actually made almost exactly the same amount of money. It's about $200 million each.
I wonder how much money Jesus made over the weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Can we measure that?
Sunday is his big fundraising day. Wow.
And Jesus got a lot of good publicity from the French Olympics, right? Opening ceremony.
Absolutely. Absolutely correct. Yeah. Shout out to The Last Supper. My cultural recommendation, I'm continuing my midlife crisis of uncritically enjoying Ken Burns documentaries. And so my latest is one that Nick almost certainly hates on Hemingway, Ernest Hemingway, that came out two or three years
Ernest
ago.
Ernest Hemingway, not Margot.
I believe Marielle is my only Hemingway personal choice all the way down. Personal best, actually. Totally have enjoyed it so far. I've watched two of the three episodes, four of the 6 hours, I guess. And about each hour is dedicated to a different Hemingway wife, pretty much. He's cycling from one to the next. A little bit, maybe too wifely, but what I, or like wife oriented. Although so was he, so it makes kind of sense. But I appreciate the way that it pulled off, so far has pulled off a difficult task, which is to convey what makes a specific writer interesting. And I've, you know, like a lot of people, went through a very long and embarrassing Hemingway phase, but he is legitimately—
Including Hemingway.
the most embarrassing Hemingway phase of all.
Yes. No, it's post phase. It conveys that, and it also conveys his self-parody and his use of his own kind of persona and why he does it. But it conveys the language and the mastery of what he does. The MVP by far is the writer Edna O'Brien, who I'm not familiar with, but that's just because I'm an ignoramus. Her discussion of him, flaws, but also brilliance, the famous first sentence of Farewell to Arms, and also various bits about the hills like White Elephants and up in Michigan and Indian camp. Just they really brought out what makes those things incredible and searing and will last forever in a way that some of the people that Hemingway elbowed in the throat on his way towards success don't seem to last in the same way, which is a tragedy for them. And, he was a bad man in many ways. And I love how Martha Gellhorn just outreported him in a way during World War II that robbed him of whatever was left of his masculinity. That's very satisfying. But very good documentary, in my opinion. Nick, do you have a quick counterpoint?
I have a question for you first.
Yes.
What, at your peak Hemingway fandom, what was your favorite Hemingway?
I it's complicated to answer. But I enjoy A Movable Feast, actually, which you're supposed to be embarrassed by, but I really, really enjoy it, including the regret that is soaked all through it. The Sun Also Rises has a special place, but my favorite was always For Whom the Bell Tolls, including its totally cringy romantic subplot with Maria. But I see it as this, as a last great gasp of his kind of literary potency. Nick?
The best Hemingway is very clearly the Hemingway daiquiri. You just got to make it the Death and Company way.
The closing sequence in A Farewell to Arms is one of the great images of literary modernism, I think. And I think that will outlive him. Matt, I have a great Hemingway story about a high school nun who taught us in AP English, Hills Like White Elephants, which is, to spoil it for people who haven't read it in the, I don't know, 80 years since it first appeared, it's about an abortion that is never spoken. And one of the smart kids in the class, a girl, said, like, the nun was like, what's this, you know, what's going on in this story? And this girl said, well, you know, they're talking about an abortion. And the nun was like, no, they're not. We are not going to talk about abortion in this classroom.
Wow, that's so great.
And it was like, wow, you know, that may have been more important in my intellectual development or orientation towards authority than anything else, where you are assigned a story about abortion and then you are not allowed to talk about it. But my question, Matt, to you is, like, why do you think Hemingway has faded? I mean, within our lifetime, He went from being the writer that certainly all men and even a lot of women emulated or wanted to be. And that just does not seem to be the case anymore.
I think it's more that writing has faded, that nothing matters, that the novel has gone. We don't have the swashbuckling heroes and heirs. I mean, a lot of the, and you know this stuff better than I do, so I'm embarrassing myself by talking about it, but a lot of the post-war writers were trying to do a Hemingway, right? Norman Mailer was trying to do a Hemingway. Hunter Thompson was trying to do a Hemingway. I don't know if you could say Tom Wolfe was. He was doing something semi-new. But I don't think that there's been a whole lot of kind of new, holy cow, this is the person to look for. Maybe if I'm taking the premise correctly, that part of it is the cringe of watching someone so consciously trying to build a myth. Like, it becomes more of a phase that you need to grow out of.
Especially how it ends, right?
Yeah, which he's foreshadowed throughout. But the thing that he does that still lasts, and I think it's why we'll go to him in the way that we'll go to Mark Twain, we go to some other people, is just that it's American English. It's declarative sentences. One of the best things that was observed in the Hemingway series, someone said, like, a lot of the high modernists were difficult. Like, it was difficult to read Joyce and Faulkner and all these people. Hemingway was not difficult. It was written for, like, 16-year-olds to at least understand the words on the page, if not quite get the full, Sister Catherine in Morristown. Yeah,
Sister Maureen. We used to call her Moby for reasons that I won't go into. But.
All right. That's all of the non-abortion talk that we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable podcast. Please listen to all of our podcasty work at reason.com/podcasts. You can also donate to our operation at reason.com/donate. Are there any events, Nick, in New York City? I believe there's a Soho Forum debate in August that looks sensitive.
There is a Soho Forum debate coming up. That's about why people should vote for Trump or someone else, featuring Libertarian Party presidential candidate Chase Oliver. Go to reason.com/events to find out all the details and to get your ticket before they disappear like Hemingway's prose.
Like Tears in the Rain. He's debating Art Laffer, who is older even than Joe Biden, as a matter of fact. Okay, we'll see you next year, week, whatever. Goodbye.